Blog Talk Radio. Anyone charged with a criminal matter has the right to have their case heard before a judge or judicial officer of the court is entitled to a fair and public hearing by a competent, independent and impartial court. Have strict court rules enforced such as the right of reply, rules of evidence, and be found innocent or guilty beyond reasonable doubt. Yet, our most vulnerable can have their rights, assets, and decision-making rights removed by a public servant of the state, not a judge, in a tribunal setting that can ignore evidence and facts and determine matters as they see fit and conclude matters based on probabilities alone. Are you scared yet?
Are you scared yet, everybody? Good evening. This is Marty Oakley of the PPJ Gazette Online, and this is the TS Radio Network. Tonight's show is in the mix, and with it is one of everybody's favorite people, Kaz Wittenscape. And we're going to be discussing a lot of things tonight. And Kaz is going to lead off tonight in something she's wanted to do for a while. We're here at her bakery making cookies for Christmas, and I drove over, so we are broadcasting from Rosie's Bakery tonight, and Kaz wants to talk about her dad. She felt like she needed to give this man a tribute, and after all the work that she's done this year on so many cases here in Alaska, Pennsylvania, all over the place, we decided to do this. So, Kaz, I'm going to let you pick it up from there. She's not talking. And I bet the connection is bad again. Kaz, hang on, everybody. We're going to have to, she's going to call back in. I'm standing right here. What do you want me to do? I can't get you up on here. Just keep stirring your cookies. Okay. Anyway, hang on, everybody. She's trying to get back in. Here we go.
Can you hear me?
Okay.
Oh, can you hear me?
I can hear you. I can hear you
now.
Yes.
We're in two different parts of the bakery because we didn't want to echo. So I'm calling from the lobby and you're back there in the bakery frosting cookies.
Thank you. And I wondered if that was the problem, but go ahead.
Well, I'm so excited. You know, another reason why I wanted to really talk about my dad is because he did work for the United States government. And right now we just look at the government and we think that it's so corrupt, especially all of us who have been victimized in these probate courts and just with the guardianship. And you go to every sort of agency and it's like they're all in on it and they're just all it makes you lose hope in our government. And I thought, you know what, it's almost Christmas time and it's time for us to have some hope. And I thought I would tell about my dad, who pretty much had his whole career working for the United States government. He had started as a stockbroker and then ended up working with the Securities and Exchange Commission. He was the chief investigator for the Securities Exchange Commission. He was their top investigator in the whole United States. He ended up, I was born in D.C. and we lived in Maryland until I was in high school. And then he ended up taking a job in Chicago, which is what moved us up there. And he ended up being the chief executive officer of the Midwest region of the Securities and Exchange Commission. And he really went after some big, big names. And if my dad was still alive and in his prime, these assholes would be sitting in jail as we speak. So they are very lucky that Stanley Witten, who is Harvey Witten's baby brother, is not around to take these guys down. But the kind of guys that my dad took down would make the Ottholes look like amateur hour. And growing up in the 80s, this all happened in the 80s, I would hear all the stories, you know, in the house. My dad worked a lot of hours. He had what was like a righteous anger, like these things just like made him angry. He was like a pit bull that would just fight and not let go until he could seek justice and do the right things. And he was not for sale. And one of the big names that he took down was a man named Ivan Boesky. And I remember hearing about the trial when he was out there. There's a lot of mafia involved in these in this securities fraud. And so he had his own personal FBI agent. Her name was Elaine, that traveled around with him. And when my husband and I were married, we had about two tables of FBI agents at our wedding that were all his buddies. Oh. And his office was down there in the FBI building there in Chicago. Anyway, so he had his own personal FBI agent that flew around with him. And he flew around the world. And I'll tell some of those stories. But so during the Ivan Boesky trial, they rented out two floors of the Trump Plaza. Interestingly enough, I remember him telling me that a glass of orange juice was like $14. And this is back in the 80s.
Oh.
Anyway, he had one of his witnesses. So he used to put people in witness protection programs, and they would like testify on some of these things. Well, he tells a story that, and this was at the Trump Plaza in the 80s, that the door opens up and he's standing right next to his witness. And his witness, this is during the Ivan Boesky trial, his witness was shot dead and they didn't kill my father. And after that, they always had, this is a true story. And after that, they would have guards like to go up and down on these elevators and to get, you know, the witnesses in and out. But you know what, even though they were killing witnesses and everything else that they were doing, it didn't scare him, and he didn't go running and saying, you know what, I almost was dead. Like that one more, I mean, how hard would it have been to have shot my father also? The only thing that I have heard is the reason that they didn't is if you get caught and you have done something like that, your penalty is so much worse if you would actually shoot a government investigator.
An agent. Yes.
Yeah.
Wow.
And I'm very grateful that that did not happen. But, you know, it didn't make him quit. I mean, that was a message. He was sent a message, go away and stop prosecuting this. And he didn't go away because he was going to do the right thing. And Ivan Boesky at the time got a record fine from the Securities and Exchange Commission, a $100 million fine. And he just ripped off so many people. He was the inspiration. There was a movie that came out called Wall Street. Do you remember that movie? Anyway, it was loosely based on this man, and it's all about greed and, you know, just selling your soul for money. And, you know, it's just what I grew up hearing. Now, the next guy that he takes down, it was kind of around the same era, and we have a guy named Michael Milken, the junk bond king. I used to hear about him, you know, living at home and just hearing about this guy. And the thing that my dad said is what was so disgusting about these men is that they ripped off the elderly's retirement accounts, and that people who had worked their whole lives and they don't get it back, you know.
Right.
And he was just so disgusted. And if my dad was alive today and knew what these Ottholes were doing, they would so go down. But he would just be so disgusted, because that was one thing that he was so disgusted with Ivan Boesky and Michael Milken, was just what they did to the elderly and to people who worked their whole life for these retirement accounts, you know. I mean, people work hard. Everyone works hard. And for these crooks to just steal it all for their own personal gain, it's just beyond disgusting.
Well,
and we see it going on in probate court. Yeah?
Yes. Ed, back in 2007 and then into the fall, actually 2008, and it carried over into 2009 when the stock market supposedly collapsed and everybody lost their money, but everybody that lost their money lost their retirement accounts and their retirement investments. Everybody at the top took the money and went home to their palatial estates, and nobody got charged with a crime, nothing. The only people that lost there were the elderly, for the most part, and people who had planned for their retirement. And now we've got these banks, the Fed is loaning these banks an average of $960 million per day because they're insolvent. See, their own corruption has come full circle. So the attack on the elderly is going to ramp up because that's where any remnants of wealth by the general population lies, is with the elderly. They own 60% of all the real property, unencumbered by debt in most cases. And so you're going to see this ramp up. We sure could have used your dad. We sure could have.
Yeah, and, you know, he retired in 1995. And he just, you know, I can still remember the Enron scandal was going down when he was in retirement. And he'd watch this on TV, and he goes, "How did the SEC not catch this?" He goes, "Oh, my gosh." And he was pretty disgusted. He's like, "It's like they've gone downhill. I would have caught this one. How did it get this far?" And I would hear him talking like that. But then, so anyway, a side note with Michael Milken, he went to the University of Pennsylvania. I wonder if he learns corruption there. Makes me wonder,
yeah,
you know?
They must teach that, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, there's our favorite state. Anyway, Michael Milken gets charged with racketeering, security fraud, tax evasion. He gets a $600 million fine. But today, according to his wiki page, he has a current net worth of $3.7 billion, and he served about 22 months in prison. So he's doing just fine.
Yes.
Yeah.
And prison for him isn't like it would be for you or I. It's just like when they had Jeffrey Epstein in prison the first time. He was out 12 hours a day, 7 days a week on work release and had to come back to the prison. And he wasn't in a cell. He was in a suite. And he wore his own clothes and he had a private bathroom with a shower. And, you know, he had television and whatever else he wanted. It was just a on-property little apartment suite because, you know, people that are important like that, they can't be put in one of those jail cells, you know, like we put regular prisoners in. And God forbid they should have to wear an orange jumpsuit.
I know.
Yeah.
I heard the food they eat is good, too, in those special jails.
Jeffrey Epstein was able to have his food catered in. And many of these people, what they call white-collar country clubs, that are supposed to be prisons, they have a menu that they can choose from that is absolutely, you'd think you were in some five-star restaurant, you know. They aren't missing anything, you know.
Yeah.
It just, I don't know. But we sure could use a Stanley Whitten now. Yes,
and
we could.
Yes, we could. I miss him a ton. And this is just like a really special one. And Michael Volpe one time told me he would love to write a story about my dad. He just found it so interesting. And the story is the final character that I'm going to share. And it's a bad guy named Tommy Quinn. Now, my dad spent his whole career chasing down Tommy Quinn. Tommy Quinn had 5 decades of crime that he was getting away with. He stole about $500 million from, you know, the usual ways of with securities fraud and ripping off people. And he left the United States to flee, and he lived in France. So my dad, they used to go over to France, and he actually helped the nation of France set up their commodities markets, and so that they could have like markets and things. And that was a big deal. But I remember him telling me the story that him and some of the agents drove along some backcountry roads in France, and they drove by his sprawling estate. This is Tommy Quinn's estate. I mean, this guy was just living the life of luxury over there, you know, in his French estate. He was.
Wow.
And so I have two fun airport stories. So what my dad did is, so when you're going to come into the United States, there's like a watch list. And so they had Tommy Quinn's name on the watch list. And one time, so my dad's working in Chicago, and this was like the adventure story. So whenever you're flying, You're going to think of the story now. So they get a call. Tommy Quinn is coming into O'Hare. So all the agents, you know, jump down, and they're going to get down there to O'Hare. So meanwhile, the plane that this guy named Tommy Quinn, I'm going to tell you, it wasn't the Tommy Quinn that they wanted. So anyway, this plane, they start circling the airport. And have you ever been up in a plane and they're like, oh, we can't land yet, we're circling?
Yep.
They had that plane. They had that plane circling because all the agents were on their way to O'Hare because they were going to ID Tommy Quinn and arrest him. So the plane is circling around until all the agents could get in place. Once the plane lands, you know how when a plane lands and they have you come up to that like arm thing that comes off and then you walk off that thing and into the airport? Well, this plane that Tommy Quinn was on, they couldn't land like that. They had to land off on a different runway, and then they brought steps on, and they had to walk down the steps, and then they had to get like on a tram, like a little tram, and get a ride in. Meanwhile, all the agents were dressed up as like airport people. So first thing they do is they go on. They don't unload the plane yet. Nobody knows what's going on. They just figure, you know, oh, it's really full. We can't, you know, unload up there. So the agents get on. They walk through. They knew where this guy was supposed to be sitting. They walk through the plane and they look at Tommy Quinn, and it is not the Tommy Quinn that they wanted to arrest. But anyway, they had the whole stakeout set up, and the guys are driving in the tram. And my dad, I remember him telling me this story. He goes, that guy has no idea, because the guy never knew. No one made contact with him. He goes, that guy has no idea that this flight circled O'Hare and landed off over here, because he had the same name as this guy on the no-fly list. Isn't that a crazy story?
Wow. Wow.
The guy had no idea. So you don't know. People could be, you know, you might have the same name as someone, and you're on the stakeout and you have no idea what was going on behind the scenes. It was because of you. So that was one of the fun adventure stories that he had told me. And then anyway, before he retired, he had made sure that Tommy Quinn's name was on that, you know, if he ever flew into the United States, he was under arrest. So here it is. My dad retired in 1995, and it was like he didn't get his man, you know, and it's 2000. He died in 2011. So it's early 2011, and Tommy Quinn's mom is very sick. So Tommy Quinn flies into JFK Airport in New York, and because of all the paperwork that my dad did before my dad retired, Tommy Quinn was arrested at JFK Airport. So if you Google my dad's name and Tommy Quinn, there's two articles in the Wall Street Journal that you can read, and he has some quotes, and he had a reporter that he used to always talk with because it's securities, and he used to be talking with this reporter in the Wall Street Journal. They would, you know, print a lot of these different stories that have to do with all these bad guys. And anyway, he called my dad and got some different quotes from my dad on what he remembered about Tommy Quinn, two different stories there. And so, and that was the beginning of 2011. And so at the end, you know, my dad is at the end of his life, and we knew that the Tommy Quinn trial was going on during the time that my dad was pretty much at the end of his life. And it was something that he's very interested in. And we were able to get into his email. We were able to email all his friends to let him know, you know, give him a phone call. My dad was so social, and everyone was calling and talking with him and giving him the update on the Tommy Quinn trial. I think it was like a 10-day trial. Anyway, my dad slips into a coma, and the hospice is there. We had a good hospice, a Grace hospice. Anyway, the hospice is there. My dad's in a coma, and obviously he hadn't had anything to drink. And usually they say someone can't go past 4 days like that. And the hospice worker said to us, she said, there's something, your dad can't go yet. There's something that he has to know. And we were all, and, you know, we kept hearing it. They're like, it's like there's something that's not finished. And your dad's not going to go until something's finished. And we just couldn't figure out what it was. Was it that it was right around the same date that my mom had passed away 2 years before? Was it around, because it was right around, you know, his parents' wedding anniversary? What was it? What was it that my dad was waiting for? And 4 days come and go, and all of a sudden it was like the Tommy Quinn trial. My dad needs to know how it ended. So we got a hold of an SEC employee, told them who we were, told them, and this person knew who my dad was, and they said it seems like he needs to know something. And they said, that is so your dad. That is so Stan. Anyway, they say, you tell your dad, I'm going to try not to cry. You tell your dad, he got his man. He said that he was found guilty and that the judge would be sentencing him in the next week and that he would not see the light of day for the rest of his life. He would live in jail. And we were able to go tell my dad, Dad, you got your man, told him everything that the agent had told us. And my dad passed away a few hours later. And he so focused on getting this guy. He couldn't even die until he knew that he had gotten his man. And that is the kind of government investigator that we need today to be looking into these things. And I believe that they still exist. I can't believe that there's no more good guys out there. And I believe that my dad was there. But, you know, the thing is that all this stuff with Harvey hadn't even happened yet. So this was the next battle left for my sister and I to fight. And so we always knew, we called it like a righteous anger. My dad just had this righteous anger. Like, if you did something wrong, if you tried to give him a service fee on a credit card or anything that he didn't feel was, he was going to sue you. And I have a funny attorney story. So my dad was not a lawyer, but in California, you don't have to have a law degree to take the bar. So he flies out to California, he's doing some work stuff, passes the bar, comes back to Chicago and hung his law degree in the employee bathroom. That's what he thought of a lawyer. Oh, he couldn't stand lawyers. So he just had this righteous anger. And when all of a sudden all this corruption that we were seeing that was happening to Harvey, and I mean, we were threatened. We were, I mean, the things that were done to us. I mean, you know the stories. I don't need to repeat them.
Yes.
But the fact that I didn't know what that was like. I didn't understand what drove my dad until this happened. And then I realized whatever was inside of him is inside of me, and it's inside of my sister, Mary. And there's just this drive, like, are you kidding me? I mean, we're not going away. These at-holes can threaten everything that they threaten to us and do everything that they do to us. We're not going away because I'm going to be like my dad. And it might not be that I can't die until I know I got my man and he's in jail, you know? And I just really just believe that, what my dad took down, these at-holes, they're like, I mean, they're amateur hour. And I know that somewhere out there is an investigator, and we just have to find him, and we just have to keep banging on those doors and telling our stories and working together. And we are going to find that person who is going to say, oh, heck no, and is going to be like my dad and take these people down. And that is my story of encouragement, that I want people, when we think, oh, the whole government is corrupt, and there's so many stories. You know what? Not all of them are. And I still believe that someone somewhere out there is as amazing as my dad, and they will go after the bad guy. And that is my Christmas wish.
Well, may it be granted. The thing is, we've had several attorneys who have tried to step out for their clients, tried to do the right thing, tried to defend them, and the court itself, these tribunals, are so corrupt. They are so lawless that they go after these attorneys. And the local bar association, I am a strong advocate for disbanding the bar, making them illegal to associate.
Yes.
as a group, because they are lethal. They have bastardized our courts. They have corrupted the judicial system. They have monopolized our courts. And monopolies are illegal in this country, supposedly. And they're running everything. They're writing the laws to benefit them. Everything has a benefit to them, or a protection racket is written into whatever they're doing to protect them from their lawlessness. The lawyers in general, not all of them, but in general, are held in such disgust and are found to be so repugnant by the majority in the public. I'm sorry, I couldn't have a job like that. I couldn't. And nothing they actually deal with these days is anything lawful. Stuff they've made legal, which is not the same as lawful. The privilege they're given, they get immunity, they get this, they get that, they get something like some protected class. And then if you try to point out, hey, wait a minute, you broke the law over here, you go to other lawyers who say, oh, no, we don't see anything wrong. Go away. That has to end. Self-policing does not work. Anytime you see self-policing for any type of organization or association of any kind, that's a protection racket. And that is exactly, a judicial oversight board's nothing more than a protection racket. And but the worst part of it is, especially with judicial oversight boards, the reason they don't see anything wrong with things the judges did, it comes before them, is they've done the same thing and worse. And we didn't think it was wrong when we did it, so we don't think it's wrong when you do it. And, you know, that's, but we need citizens' commissions. I had, again, a judge here recently tell me, he said, well, that will never work, Marty, you know, because the common person doesn't know the law. I said, well, sit in any one of these courtrooms, apparently, based on the rulings that are being handed down, neither do these so-called judges.
Couldn't
possibly do any worse. And at least we'd give it a fair shake. And so they don't like that. But this is something that has to end. When all of these governors and everybody start screaming about unions, oh, it's the unions ruining it. If it wasn't for the unions, you'd be making $1 an hour. And you'd be working 18 hours a day. And you would have no benefits if it wasn't for the unions. Now, granted, some of them got out of hand. They sure did. But what they don't like is that unions do have power now by number. So they want rid of the, oh, the unions are costing us money. Okay, let's start. If we're going to get rid of unions, let's start with the biggest, most lucrative, most powerful union in the country, the bar associations.
Oh, I think that's a great idea.
Start with them first and work your way down. And and prevent them... because when two or more of them get together, somebody's going to hang. And it's going to usually be for profit. It's a sick business. It should have been. Do you know that originally law school was not required? In California, I didn't know this about California till you told me. But law school is not required. You traveled with another attorney, and Marcel had told me one time, she said, early on in our country, she said, households had two books if they were lucky. One was the Bible, and one was a law book. And they had these traveling judges. Remember, the traveling judges came around. They didn't have any law degrees, but they were studied in the law. And so in order to become a traveling judge that went around, you know, listening to cases, you apprenticed with someone who was already doing it. And then you became proficient and, you know, or supposedly so, and you became a traveling judge. But we didn't have these courtrooms until these larger cities started blowing up, and we didn't have fixed courtrooms. But it's just one of the things I learned from John LaCron. In talking to him, which I think is probably every year I hear one or two things that just out of everything else I've heard over the year, it's like, boom, that one's a killer. Where the word testimony comes from. And he said, do you know what that word means? And I said, well, it means that you testify. He said, but do you know what the word testify means? Testimony. And I said, no, he said, originally, there was no putting your hand on the Bible and raising your right hand and swearing an oath. He said, only men were allowed to speak. And he said, they stood and put their hand over their testicles. And he said, testimony. He said, the testicles talking. He said, on penalty of pain and perjury, they would put their hand over their testicles and swear to tell the truth, because to not do so would be the end of their life, signified by their testes, where life originates from. And he said, so this is what would happen. He said, and women, of course, were not allowed to speak. So he said, but it was men who stood up and they would put their hand over their testes and swear to tell the truth, otherwise face penalties. Things like that just always rock me. I had no idea.
Wow.
And I looked it up. It is Latin. And just like the word government means govern is mind, and government is mind control. That's what the word government means. And all these words that we use, we don't know their origins. And if you do, you know, it's like, wait, that's not what I thought.
Wow.
But, yeah.
That's so interesting.
Things. And the other thing I didn't know, too, which this will, in these guardianship cases, anything that asks for your signature is a contract. That is a corporate signing. If under that line it says signature, as a individual person, you give your autograph. And there is a difference. That's the difference between autograph and signature. You, as a signature, you're signing or accepting commercial value, that you have commercial value. You can be bought, sold, and traded. But your autograph carries no commercial value. And I had no idea. And that's why, you know, when people ask you to autograph their picture, what you're basically saying, this has no commercial value. You can't sell it.
Oh.
It has no commercial value.
And yet people sell these autographs of old, you know, old autographs all the time.
Yeah. Yep.
Wow. That's
but
so
it's
interesting.
Just things, yeah, it's just things I've learned, you know. And in talking to so many people over the year, because, my God, the information that people have, you know, just like this story about your dad, I had no idea.
Mm-hmm.
That anybody was ever out there running these guys down.
Especially
these Wall Street crooks. And I say that the banks right now, the Fed is loaning them $960 million a day, the four big global banks. And I think J.P. Morgan is the other one. But there's four of them. But they are so insolvent. And, of course, our money is not real money. It's a debtor's note.
Mm-hmm.
It costs us 14 to 16 cents every time we use one of these Federal Reserve notes. We go another 14, 16 cents in debt. And when they say the full faith and credit of the United States, what they are talking about is you. They are talking about your labor, your property, your land. They put you up as collateral. That is the full faith and credit of the United States. So when they start take on a massive, huge debt or do some other damn thing and say it's backed by the full faith and credit. In other words, we took everybody else's stuff and their property and their money and their assets and everything and put it up as collateral for what we're about to do.
Yeah.
The things I have learned, and it's called hypothecation. They hypothecate your land, your property, your labor, and they do sell our labor. But it's just, and the thing is, I keep telling people too, because every bill that comes out federally, at least, that has anything to do with the elderly, and these are all fluff and buff bills. They are do-nothing bills. They make
mm-hmm.
suggestions, and they talk about internet scams and wire fraud, but there is absolutely not one damn thing in there citing a crime by these for-profit guardians, by these vultures that are preying on the elderly. there is nothing in there of any use or value to the cause we have devoted ourselves to. And but these bills come out, but the very first place they go when they are presented is to the Energy and Commerce Committee. Now, why would that be? It would be because you're in commerce. You are being bought, sold, and traded. And from there, you are being parceled out to the Committee on Aging, to Health and Human Services, and this one and that one. And that's another thing, like the Senate Committee on Aging. Oh, they meet once a year, every year, so they can collect their check for holding that chair down. Mm-hmm. They are a non-regulatory committee. They have no force or effect. It's basically a bitch session. And they, oh, it's terrible, it's bad. No, we need to do something about this. And they get up and leave the room, pick up their check, and forget you were ever there. I don't bother with things like that. But here we're being forced to pay for this non-functional committee. Go ahead.
When we were first like trying to get our information, you know, once Harvey was caught in his abusive guardianship, I went and got the names of all the people on that committee. I did contact Tammy Baldwin here in Wisconsin, and I actually got a respectable response. She said, you know, and I'm sure it was an aide who wrote it, that, you know, obviously he's in Pennsylvania, I'm in Wisconsin, she can't do anything. But what they said was, figure out how you can file a federal complaint. And that's when we figured out, and because of that information that we were given through her office, that's when we were able to file Medicare fraud, which ended up landing on the desk of the Attorney General, Kathleen Kane, which unfortunately she investigated it and then they put her in jail. But when we contacted Bob Casey, he's just, oh my gosh, he is a terrible person. I can't believe he got reelected.
He is.
He's on that same committee, and I did not get the same sort of answer out of him as I did out of Tammy Baldwin. In fact, he's a deflector. He's a I think one of them was, well, you don't live in Pennsylvania, so I don't have to answer you. Well, my uncle's here and he lives in Pennsylvania, and this is a problem. You know, I mean, it's just he was a terrible person. Terrible.
Bob Casey, years ago, we had an advocate. Oh my God, Tracy Miller. And Tracy has passed away.
I remember Tracy.
Yes. And she was, her brother Bob had been caught in one of these guardianships. And he was caught, he got shot at an ATM making a deposit for his business. And of course, there was a huge settlement over that. They immediately landed on this man. And Tracy fought for her brother till the day she died. She fought for her brother.
Yes, she did.
And she went, Bob Casey, she contacted him several different times. And initially, oh, yeah, he was going to do something. Oh, he was going to be right there. And this is terrible. And he wasn't going to let this happen. But it became very apparent as time passed, this jackass wasn't going to do a damn thing. In fact, right before she died, she had contacted him again, and he didn't answer her. When she passed away, I wrote Mr. Casey a letter that probably set his monitor on fire when it opened up. That part of what contributed to her early death was the stress caused in part by him. He's worth, absolutely worthless. He's for sale.
He's a scumbag.
Yeah, he's a toadstool. One of the things I want to say, too, whenever you're approaching senators or representatives, state or federal, about any topic that is going to be of national review or in your state, if there's a law coming up and let's say one or two or three legislators are sponsoring it, and let's say you call their office or you email them, the first thing they want to know is, what's your zip code? What do you care? Well, if you're not in our district, you know, it's a congressional courtesy. We can't talk to you. Then will you please do me a favor? And when you vote for that bill, please attach a signing statement to it. You know, like George Doofus Bush did when he intended not to obey a federal law that got passed. He attached a signing statement to it. And you attach a signing statement saying that whether you vote yes or no, your vote, the result of your vote, will apply only to the people in your district. Well, we can't do that.
I like that.
I said, yeah, you are elected to help represent this state. And that means that whether I'm in your district or out of this, if you're going to be voting on this bill, you speak to me. It doesn't matter what district I'm in. You speak to me. Well, you need to go to your own district representative. If I wanted to talk to them, I'd have called them. I didn't. I called you. Your name's on that bill.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I've gone round and round. Don't let them get away with this. On the federal level, same thing. Well, out of congressional courtesy, you know, if you're not in my state, and no. No, you stood up and took an oath to the Constitution of the United States of America. That includes all of us. It didn't say just the people in your state. It did not say that. You did not swear an oath just to the people in your state. Now, did you? And don't let them get away from that. It's called zipping. And it's how they avoid speaking to the public about issues that concern them. And they have all sorts of things. When you're emailing a senator or a representative, either state or federal, I know people think it makes them look grandiose to have all these email addresses exposed, including every media outlet they can possibly get an address on, and they send it. Now, let me tell you exactly what happens. When their mail system detects all these exposed addresses, that email gets shredded. Got it? Nobody reads it. Nobody looks at it. Stop doing that. And the other thing is, you send your emails one at a time. Do not blind copy, carbon copy anyone else on that email, because their programs can also pick that up. And a news desk, you want to send them a story, you send it individually one at a time. And if they reject the story, you go to the next one. Because if these news desks are all looking at all of these media outlets you contacted with this same story, and they all throw it right in the trash, because if you send it to everybody else, they're not going to be the first to report. They don't want it. So you keep shooting yourself in the foot. And I know there's people out there that think it just makes them look so important to have all these email addresses attached. Look how important. Look at all the people I have on my email list. You don't know those people. What are you talking about?
Those massive things, I don't even read them, because I'm like, feel like it's like a spam or something.
And it draws phishing scammers who get in those emails and access people's address books. It's all kinds of malware attaches to that. Don't do it. Be professional if you're going to contact people. Do it one at a time. It's not that difficult. And nobody's impressed seeing every. Go ahead.
I have a funny story. It's like one of my funniest stories. So, see, I'm going to change the names to protect the innocent. Never the guilty. Deb Clack, the Guardian, must have got one of these computer virus things. And have you ever seen them? Like, all of a sudden you get some kind of like, it was just a link. I didn't click the link. Anyway, the link had your address book. Her whole address book was connected to this one email that was some kind of like a virus. And all of a sudden, I got this email with all her whole address. And I thought that maybe something funny could be done with that whole email address. So anyway, the Rebel Pundit articles had just recently come out that Michael Volpe had written, and it didn't paint her in a good light. And so somebody that I know, I'm going to forward you a virus. Don't open the link, but I'm going to send you some interesting email addresses. And then I guess that because I was in that email thing too. I got the email that said Deb Clack makes the news, and it was the most delightful email. And it went to everyone in her address book.
Oh God!
I love that virus.
Oh wow!
I love that virus. I didn't do it,
yes.
But I got the virus.
Yes.
So, you know, and I
yes.
won't say who did.
Well,
but I thought that was
just
funny.
The other thing too was yes. And I've been asked by several people to bring this up because people are complaining about their being called for their contacts, their email contacts, and being told, well, I need everybody you're in contact with, especially if it's media or politicians, you need to give me all those that don't you do that. If you want to get doors slammed in your face real quick, you just start passing out any contacts you've made. Don't ever pass out anyone's contact information without first getting their permission to share it.
Absolutely.
That you don't just collectively hand over someone all of your contacts. And the people who are asking you for it, of course, then say, I've got thousands of people following me. No, you don't. You have thousands of stolen email addresses. That there's a difference. Everybody we have signed up, and I think between all of us, oh my God, it's approaching somewhere around 300,000 between all of our collections and groups. And but we keep everybody's information private. We don't share that with anyone. We don't sell those lists. We don't give them away. Don't do that. Do not do that. Keep your, unless you get someone's direct permission and tell them specifically who you will be sharing their personal information with and give them the opportunity to say yes or no, you don't just categorically go through there and hand over your list. Please don't do this. Please don't. This is, I was talking to some of the people, it was either with Netflix or another outfit out there out east, and I can't remember which one, but anyway, I was talking to them. They were talking about how one of their phone numbers had gotten out, and they had to have the line disconnected because one advocate, in supposed advocate in particular, was incessantly calling because they were so important. I received a phone call from a group in Michigan yesterday, or the day before, absolutely upset that they felt cyber stalked. This insistence of pushing in to a situation where the person was neither wanted nor invited, and that this was nonstop, 24 hours a day. I've had the same thing happen to me, and so have many other people. Anybody that's operating on this way, you need to keep your distance, stay away. This is somebody that isn't about the cause. This is a huge ego at work there. I call them a malignant narcissist, I believe, because you call them glory hogs.
Speaking of glory hogs, that was a great show. I got a lot of emails on that. People never heard that term. Marty, that reminds me, we were going to start a new, on our show, we were going to have, you know how it's like someplace people have like the wall of shame? We were going to have the glory hog of the week.
Oh,
should we do that now? Or like, should I tell you? Should we tell my story? Because I got a glory hog. Oh,
okay.
My gosh, Marty. So, Marty, this is breaking news because we are listened from the North Pole to the South Pole and everywhere in between. It appears that a certain elf in Santa's toy shop likes to tune into us, and he wanted to let me know about a glory hog. This is happening in Santa's workshop. So anyway, it appears that Blitzen was all wanted to be like leading Santa's sleigh and being like the number one reindeer, and he was picking on Rudolph, and he wouldn't let Rudolph play in any reindeer games. And he even, you know what he even did to Blitzen? He sent like mean email. He sent mean emails around about Rudolph to everybody. I mean, he's just a bully. Blitzen. Just picking on Rudolph and sending mean emails and bad mouthing Rudolph, and you know, it's just not right. And Blitzen wanted to be the one to lead Santa's sleigh. Well, of course we know how the story ends. Well, anyway, certain elf told me that Donner was a little teed off about all this, you know, because people don't like seeing Rudolph get picked on. I mean, give him a break. Mm-hmm. So anyway, so Santa had to put Blitzen kind of in the middle of the group because he was not going to be doing the rain. He's not going to let him, you know, lead the thing.
Yes.
And Rudolph, like we know, gets to be the top one. So anyway, Donner was so upset with Blitzen that he ate some tacos the night, like a few hours before they left for their, you know, their evening. And I guess every time they landed on a roof, Blitzen was like, he was like trying so hard to get to the chimney. He's like, oh, can I just get a whiff of some chestnuts roasting on an open fire? Because Donner was basically letting Blitzen taco snarf the whole time while they were flying around. So that's what happened to Glory Hog.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
I know. I should write children's books, shouldn't I?
That was
the elf in the North Pole. He called and he said, you know, Marty, he's one of your biggest fans. They listen to all your shows, not just the one that me or you were on. He listens to all of them up there in the North Pole while they're building toys.
Wow. You know, and that is one of the things that came up this, you're so crazy, it came up this last year that really shocked me, was when people from Australia reached out to me. And apparently they had been listening to the show over there for a couple of years. And finally, through NASGA, ran me down. And we've been doing shows with them. And in speaking, I had a conference call with several of them here just the other day. And apparently they're facing the same dilemma that we are. We have these glory hogs over there that, of course, every time there's a camera comes out, they got their face in it. And nothing is happening unless they did it. If it wasn't for them, if it hadn't been them that did it, and they're, as one of the gentlemen said to me, he said, I'm just stunned by this. He said, we're all working so hard to get this stopped. He said, every time we take two steps forward, one of these glory hogs jumps out and said, look at me, I did it. And he said, it was all of us. He said, what is wrong with these people that it can't be all of us? It was all of us fighting this. And I said, I don't know. I said, we run into the same thing here. But I said, there's always people in every cause, I don't care what it is, that rise up and for some reason they want to be stars. They want to be the celebrity. They want to be the one. It was them. If it hadn't been for them. And I said, basically, what they do is harass everyone. Cause on any given week, as I told you here, it was Tuesday or Wednesday, I believe Wednesday, my phone started ringing in the morning. It went till all night of people calling, what is going on? What's wrong with this person? Why are they doing this? There's a nonstop emailing, phone calling, messaging. What is this? And many people have come to the conclusion that the people who do this and who show up everywhere, whether you want them or not, are actually plants that have been sent in to derail the movement, to upend things, to mess things up, get people fighting amongst themselves. You know what I'm saying? To create havoc. And as long as you're fighting each other, of course, you're not paying attention to what's going on. I don't get into all that stuff. You have been subject to just what I have for years, just an onslaught of vicious, fictitious emails about things you're supposed to have done and said and all of this that never happened. You know, every show I did was about this specific individual, although they were never mentioned and nothing they were doing was ever mentioned because nothing they were doing was worth mentioning. And to watch this happen, this desperation to be some kind of celebrity, I don't have that drive. That's not what I'm after, and neither do you. You know, we do what we do, and because of all of this behind the scenes carrying on, we have to keep quiet what we're doing to keep it from being interfered with. You know, and
absolutely.
The people from Michigan that called me, the people from Pennsylvania that called, and everything. I told them, I said, quit announcing everything. Don't announce it to people you think are your friends or anyone else. Do what you're doing. And when it's completed, then talk about it. But quit giving these people a heads up because it's just fodder. That's all it is. You know, it's just a means and a way for them to find something else to stick their nose in. I've never seen it in all of the, of course, I've been in politics 30, 40 years to one degree or another. I have never seen anything as virulent as this, the people that this cause can produce. I have never seen people so desperate. I mean, absolute desperation to be seen as some sort of star. I'm saving the day. And by the way, one of them even called over to Australia and told them that he had single-handedly been responsible for the prosecution and imprisoning of numerous probate judges.
Yeah,
here
name
in the
one.
State. Name
they
one.
They get away with it. Yeah.
Yeah, name one. And
you know,
it's
such a serious situation. I mean, these are people's families. This isn't like, I mean, my dad went after people who were stealing money and everything, and that's, it's really bad. I mean, absolute destruction. But this is lies. These are people, this is murder. This is, I mean, I cannot imagine to be isolated from my family. You know, Marty, one time I was sitting there and I was thinking, what is worse? Abortion or this guardianship? Like, you know, in abortion, you know, we have a baby and the baby's died, but the baby has no knowledge of what just happened or knows what's coming on. And the more I thought about it, and I think both are sad, but when you're an elderly person and you've lived your whole life and your family is your everything, and now you've been isolated from them, and you have this whole life of like knowledge that you have in your head, like you know what's been done, you know, I absolutely think that it's worse. And I don't understand why the pro-life movement doesn't seem to care about this issue. That's just
because
how I think.
I cannot tell you the number of churches I have contacted who have had parishioners or congregational, you know, people that have been in their parish or congregation for 20, 30, 40, 50 years in some cases, and said they've been targeted by this guardian and they have isolated them and taken them away from their family. They're in the process of stealing their property and all their possessions. And I need you to stand up and support this person and be there. Oh, we can't do that because that's political and we'd lose our tax exempt status. No, that is humanity. That is a humanitarian cause. Isn't that what Christ was about? And you're talking politics and your tax status, but they will not stand up. They'll scream and cry about, oh, we're pro-life. We're pro-life. The only thing a pro-lifer hates worse than abortion is a child on welfare. Now pick one and take a side here. If we took the money we blow on wars, on ramping up our economy and making sure there are enough jobs, and there are not enough jobs, especially since we keep ferrying in tens of thousands of people from the countries we've blown up, plus the 30 million that have crossed the southern border. But there are not enough jobs. This is why I just had this discussion last night with John LeCron. This is why, like during the Reagan administration, one of his assistants, one of his aides, said they had a terrible time trying to make him understand that 20% of the population had to be kept in abject poverty for the rest of the population to think they were doing okay. And it served two purposes. It gave them a false sense of security. And then if things went wrong, you could turn around and point at these people that you trapped in this system and say it's all their fault. They're lazy. They just don't want to work. That's not the case. There are not enough. 60% of our college graduates cannot find work in the field they trained for because those jobs are being filled by special people brought in on HB5 visas, work visas. Why are we importing workers when we have people here who can't find a job? Why are we bringing people into this country that are politically, culturally, religiously opposed to us? People that our own government has told us hate us and want to kill us. Why did you bring them here and put them in our communities? I mean, I don't know if these people really do feel that way, but this is what the government said. Why did you bring them here?
Yeah.
And, you know, see, I don't understand things like that. That doesn't make sense to me. So, but there again, these are people who need jobs. And why, when we cannot provide enough jobs from the people who are here by birth or naturalization or whatever, if we don't have enough jobs, imagine this, Kaz. We have over 3 million people now sitting in prison, more than the next 5 countries put together. We have more people sitting in prison. If we were to let all those people out, let's just say we let all out, but maybe 5 million that actually needed to be there, or 500,000 that actually needed to be there.
Mm-hmm.
The rest of them, they figure the majority are in there on trumped up charges and, you know, infractions of this and that, misdemeanors got hyped up. Actually, and many of them, they're wrongly accused. In North Carolina, I think it was North or South Carolina, said that they knew they had over 600 people in their prisons that on false convictions. They figured that out because of the FBI labs and their fake. Yeah. But it would just cost too much money to try to go through all those cases and let them out. So here those people are sitting in prison.
Yeah.
Yes.
And it's mostly blue-collar crime, and it's white-collar crime. To be like, why do that holes need? And then they have enough money. They could pay for their – think of the money that the prison system could make. Mm-hmm. They could just take all their money. Like if you put assholes in prison and then take their money – you know, that should be the next thing. Oh my gosh, I just thought up a crazy business plan that would be so amazing. You know?
Well, you know, the other thing is even when they catch one of these predators like that Kathy Byers, and I'm proud to say we contributed, we were not the cause of, and it wasn't because of us, and it wasn't any of that. We contributed to that little cause there. But they got her, but nobody's going to get any restitution. She may go to prison when she gets out. All the goodies are still going to be there.
Like
nobody's
Michael Milken and
restitution.
His $2.7 billion sitting there.
And, you know, she isn't losing a thing. This is what I'm saying. Even when they catch them, and they're always low-hanging fruit, they never hit any of the big guys. They catch them and they go to prison. They're given prison sentences. It's like April Parks got 40 years. If she does 5, I would be surprised. She'll be spirited out of there quietly. But all of the billions she took from people is still there. And nobody got any restitution. No, there's no plans to, you know, marshal her estate and do have a look back period to see what all she might bought, sold, and traded with the money she stole from people, and disperse that to the families that she stole from.
Yeah.
There's no plans to do that. So whenever she gets out, everything she stole will still be there. So what's the point?
Yep. If you and I did something petty, they sure would go after us. Oh, you know, cause
damn
money,
right.
Better pay all.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. Yep.
It's something.
It, yeah. And so, you know, you see all these things, and Elaine talking about there in Pennsylvania, how they're targeting women who are getting a divorce and leaving them homeless and stripping everything from them, letting their soon-to-be ex disappear and take all the income and everything with him. And then they're trying to guardianize these women, if not take their children from them.
It's disgusting.
I tell you, I don't. Yeah, is in Pennsylvania where the Kids for Cash program was running?
Yep, one county over from the Attholes. I bet you that they all knew each other.
Oh,
I
you
mean,
bet they did.
Oh, yeah, they did.
Yep.
Yeah, it's.
Yep.
I mean, it's just absolutely disgusting. But it was, I guess, from what I had heard, there were so many of these parents were, like, beaten down the doors of the FBI. And finally, I think just so many just kept coming that they finally investigated it. And, they took some judges down. And, but, you know, in the meantime, there's some of these kids committed suicide. I mean, there's deaths. There's the greed of these judges and the destruction of the lives of these parents.
Right.
And the children that are still alive and what was done is just unreal.
Yeah, there is in the 60s, 70s, and into the 80s, they had what they called reform schools. And there was one in Iowa. I'm trying to think of the name of that place. It was El something or other, Eldora. If you got sent there, and it was for boys, they said it was worse than a federal maximum security prison. That these kids were used and abused so badly. There were deaths, beatings.
Well, I'm guessing the pedophiles all work. Yeah, the pedophiles all work there.
Yeah. And then a lot of things that we hear from people that have been in these prisons, and film is starting, if you saw any of the film on Khalif Browder, who was a boy who was accused of stealing, he was a young black man, he was 16 at the time, was accused of stealing a backpack, which, as it turned out, when he got released, he never had done. It was entirely dismissed. But they had this kid for 3 years in solitary confinement with no charges. And it was the guards, they have him on video, who beat this boy relentlessly. I mean, absolutely beat, set the other cellmates, you know, blockmates on him to gang beat him. They allowed them to rape him and kept him in a little cell that was like 5 by 6 feet. And there was a dirty mattress on the floor and a toilet, and that was it. And he was kept there for 3 years. And when he got out, he tried everything to get himself to, he eventually committed suicide. The damage was so terrible. This had affected him so terribly. And here this kid had never committed this crime. And you wonder how many people are sitting in these prisons that based on the lies told by the FBI lab, I think I just read yesterday, there's been like 688 people who have been released from prison and death row where DNA proved they never committed the crime. That is just staggering. Innocence Project, you know, that here this number of people, they've been at it for 20 years, and they have gotten 688 people out going through the case, collecting DNA, actually testing it, and here these people never did it. What they're running into is judges who say, well, we prosecuted him, they found him guilty, so we're going to go ahead and, no, you're not. And, well, we can't just let him, yeah, you are, yeah. And, and this thing about not being able to prosecute prosecutors for wrongdoing, well, you just opened the door for massive corruption.
They
can fabricate all kind of stuff. And the FBI has become literally a joke. They're really of no, when the lab got caught fudging all of those lab results to make sure the detectives got the conviction they wanted, and they find out that the one woman working in that lab wasn't even qualified to work in there and had been in there like 15, 16 years. And, but that they hear they had, you know, fabricated evidence. We don't stand a chance. I don't know how, you know, going back to the guardianship issue and going again to commerce, when our own government refers to us as a human resource. I remember it used to be when you applied for a job, you went to the personnel department.
Mm-hmm.
And then suddenly, in the early 80s, it changed to human resources. And then I started reading legislation that refers to the country's human resource, like they're talking about our fossil fuel resources, you know, our agricultural resources and our human resources. We are in trade. We are a commodity. We are a product of the country, and they're buying, selling, and trading us. Now, when you reach a certain age, they've decided you're no longer productive, therefore of no value to the corporation that we call the U.S. government, and you can check that. That's in U.S. code and title. It's a corporation. They want rid of us, but they want to rob us blind before they do it. They want to make sure they take all of our property so that there is no transference of wealth. This is the greatest theft of wealth, the greatest transfer of wealth in this country that nobody in government talks about. They scream about the transfer. They want to redistribute the wealth from the rich to the poor. No, you're taking it from the elderly and you're giving it to a special group of people that seem to be exempt from the law. You have just disinherited a family. So there is no generational wealth being passed on. You have taken everything from this family. That, and we have the right of inheritance. And there is a tort. There is a tort called tortious interference with inheritance. And it talks in there about illegal conversion of property and, you know, fraudulent conversion and this and that. And this is exactly what happens in probate court, these tribunals.
Oh, yeah. I've experienced it personally.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, legal conversion. So it's just, you know, we're up against it. And all of this goes back to the bar associations. And this is who helps. This is who writes these laws. This is who writes the statutes. There isn't a guardianship council sitting somewhere and saying, let's write this statute. It's a gang of attorneys. Write it, and it always benefits them. It always gives them immunity. It always protects them. It always makes whatever they're doing just peachy. If you or I did the same thing they did, we'd be under the prison.
Yeah. I had an attorney say to me, you know, Kaz, just because you didn't win didn't mean that you were right or that you were wrong, and if you win doesn't mean that you were right. It's just... It's just how it is.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, it's just a corruption. And, you know, and the last point, I wanted to do like one more like hopeful story, because this is so depressing, and people sit and they listen and like you lose hope, and it is, you know, and like after, you know, I said, it's like the guardianship aftermath, like your loved one's been murdered. You now suffer a legal abuse system. You are consumed with this. And then you think about it 24/7 and you kind of put yourself, I mean, it's not healthy and you have to move on with your life. I mean, I wasn't even working. I spent 40 hours or more a week. I've done my internet stalking class.
Right.
On the radio. I mean, you just, you know, finding everything that I could find and just like research and everything, and it can be all consuming. And so I wanted to just do, since we're here in my bakery, I wanted to like just tell a little bit of a story of, you know, where it came from. And so I felt after going through all this that I just can't believe people just kill people for money. You lose faith and hope in humanity, because especially anyone wearing a suit is especially to me like, what'd you do to get that? You know, I kind of think there might be more criminals like that. I mean, growing up the way I did and then, you know, actually experiencing it firsthand, your suit does not impress me. And your car does not impress me, because how did you get that? You know, and so just you know, just feeling like that and just feeling like losing hope in humanity. And you can't stay there or you'll drive yourself insane and everyone around you. And so what I did was, you know, I was a baker and I had taken some business class business planning classes. I never in a million years really thought I would open up a bakery, and because I was too chicken, but I don't know what I just did it. Some days I'm like, that was dumb. But, you know, and we have a mission statement to leave the world a little sweeter than we found it. We're a bakery. I have 3 special needs employees that work with me. I have a special needs brother myself. It's someone gave him a job. You know, it's paying it forward and having, you know, an opportunity for others. I've had formerly homeless people working for me. I mean, just if I can create my own little world of happiness and I call the rest of it my sideshow, like you can recover and you can move on because there's nothing I can do to fix what happened. It's my story. I know what goes on in the government. I know the corruption. I know it firsthand. I heard it growing up my whole life, and then I got to experience it firsthand. I know it exists, and yet you can't just live your life focusing on that. And I love the group of people that I found because there's such a camaraderie. Like, we all have been through it. We all are victims of legal abuse system. We've all been just brutalized through the system. And there's that something about it that keeps us together. And the other thing that I have noticed about all of us, Marty, I think we might all be like a type A kind of person. And
you think, maybe?
I just, yeah, like, and like almost like a girl gang, you know, like don't mess with us. I just can imagine, like, you know, we just all stick together. We all just, you know, like, yeah, I believe you. Yes, I know that really happened to you. And yes, I believe you that you did not do anything wrong to deserve this. They did this to you for their pure, you know, psychopathic reasons. And there's so few people out there in the rest of the world that can even fathom what we've all been through. And yet you can't wallow in it. You have to put on your happy face and you have to keep living your life or you're not going to make it. And so that's like my little story. You know, I created the bakery. It's sweet. I make people coffee. I make you donuts and cinnamon rolls and cream filled donuts. We're making cookies. We're going to be busy this weekend selling all of our cookies, Marty. And you just have to focus on the things in life that can be good and beautiful, because if you allow this to take you down, then they won and you can't have that.
Yes. I, you know, you have your bakery. I have my painting, which I, you know, have neglected terribly over the years, have picked that back up again. Of course, my grandkids. And by the way, I have an announcement. I have 6 grandchildren. 2 boys, 4 girls. I have 3 great-grandchildren, 2 boys, 1 girl. And I just found out I got the 4th great-grand on the way. And
congratulations.
Yeah, yes. And these are the things that keep me going. Nothing will breathe life into a family better than a new baby. I know Sophia, my great-granddaughter, is one of the happiest, most responsive. She is just something else. But what she's done for the family, you know, is just this sense of life and joy. And these are the things you need to cling to. These other things, yes, we need to address them. We need to take care of them. But you're absolutely right. You cannot let this consume you. You cannot let it take your joy from you and the pleasure in your family. You do what you have to, wage your fight. Yes, ma'am, get out there and wage your fight. But you take time out for your family, for things that bring you pleasure, to keep a healthy balance. You have to do this. Otherwise, and you know yourself, cause we run into these people, that this has consumed them so totally that you cannot speak to them. They go into what I call automatic pilot, and they start a recitation of a minute by minute, blow by blow, and you know, and you can't stop them, and they can't hear you when you're saying stop, please stop. They can't hear you. They're reciting, this has become so much their identity and who they are. They go into this recitation. I have learned to stay away from these people because they will eat up massive amounts of your time, and yet they don't want to do it. There have been times when I've sat for hours and listened to somebody tell these stories, made notes and everything, promised me documents, and then I've said to them, would you like to come on the radio show? Well, how much are you going to pay me to do that? What?
Uh-huh.
I'll pay you what I get paid. Nothing. Well, I'm not doing this for free. Well, you just stayed up four hours of my time.
Yeah, but the opportunity to get the story out there, they just don't get it. Wow.
Yeah, and I know I took some shots, and everybody was talking about what a cheap shot it was about me self-funding the shows, and I do. And I do it because this isn't about making money for me. We've had offers cause to go on three other large commercial stations to move all the shows over to them. We don't do it because, yes, that would make me money, but the shows would be eaten up with commercials, and I don't want to sell anything. And what I'm doing is so people can tell their story, so we can talk about these things uninterrupted. And the other thing is, immediately when you're under somebody else's thumb, it's don't talk about this and don't talk about that and don't say this and don't say that. And this is our position on this, so don't stray from that. No, no.
Yeah.
We just do our thing. And I also can monetize the shows on Blog Talk. I can sell advertising space on the shows. I don't do that either. We've had offers. I don't do that. Like I say, the shows are for us to talk. And so if those out there who think it is somehow a diminishment of me to self-fund these shows, I take a great deal of pride in that. And I'm not the one out there running around telling people you need to send me money. I don't do that. Now, that is not to say that some of my close friends in this have helped me out from time to time, because they sure have. But I don't go out and ask for donations. I don't do any of that. And we're in our 11th year. June 10th, I believe it is, we start our 12th year. I fully anticipate keeping running till we get this stopped. And but this is what the shows are about. But the thing is, you're absolutely right. You have got to keep this space in your life, this happy place that you find that you can go to, where you can get relief from all of this. If it's a hobby, if it's people you enjoy, if it's, whatever it is. If it's, just going outside and sitting and staring off into space, if that's what helps you remain calm, gives you a sense of peace, do it. Because there's no harm in it. You are not neglecting anyone or betraying anyone by doing that. If you let this consume you, you begin to fall apart. Yes, and they win. They win. So that's a very good point to bring up, a very good thing to point out to people, that you have to have this with you. It's this bakery. And by the way, I'm frosting all over my mouth.
I know you're doing good. I think your cookies look really good.
Yeah, they especially look good in my mouth. And
don't eat all the plastic, Marty.
No, I'm just eating the frosting. And but this is, that's a very, very good point to bring up. And with the holiday coming up, do what you need to do for your elderly person, but don't forget the rest of your family. Don't forget the rest of your family.
Absolutely. Yep. And I also feel if you have some free time, and especially if you have younger children, just go and visit any nursing home. Go to one where your loved one isn't being isolated, and bring your kids, because they are going to be so excited to see the young kids. bring some cookies,
yep.
go visit people. My kids were still in middle school and high school when my parents had moved into senior housing, just because they had me at a later age, and just hanging out with Bob and Harvey in the senior housing. And there's so many amazing people to talk to, and they love
mm-hmm.
having visitors. And just, you know, just go. A lot of church groups go in and do visiting,
yep.
go in on your own, and just, you know, go and just visit with no, you know, you're not there to, like, see if they did a
right.
violation or, you know, whatever. Just go and visit people. And I have just had the most amazing conversations with so many different people, just from, you know, me hanging out in the retirement homes for all the years that I did with when
mm-hmm.
my parents were living in there, when Bob and Harvey was living in there. And the stories that I've heard, there are so many people that I'll never forget, and they're so amazing. It's the greatest generation is in these nursing homes now, and they're passing away. We did,
yeah.
You know, we also own the Supper Club, and we
yeah.
do free steaks for veterans. And you know what, Marty, this year, you better have your reservation or you're not getting in. It's a crazy, crazy night. But anyway, it's a really nice thing. And all the veterans come out and they wear their outfits and their uniforms.
Yeah.
And it's just such a lovely, very lovely thing. But this year, I did not see one World War II veteran come out for Veterans Day. I'm seeing more Vietnam. And this is the first year that I haven't seen one. And so they're really getting up in their age. They're probably in their 90s
yes.
and up. And it's rare, and they're still out there. And now's the time. Go find one, talk with them, visit with them, because
yep.
these stories are going to disappear.
Yes.
And that
Which
would
is
be
exactly,
the Christmas thing. It'd be a blessing
yes.
for both of you.
Yes. And
the
this is one of the reasons
you.
In school, I got told this by a civics teacher to limit my conversations at home with my grandchildren because it interfered with the curriculum. And what she was talking about is they want us older people shut up because we remember what it was like before all this started. And we have these
yeah.
stories to tell, and it develops not only family but community. And this is another thing I've noticed. There is every effort to destroy community and the sense of family. And this isn't about who's gay and who isn't. That has nothing to do with it. The only people capable of destroying the traditional family is the government, and they're doing a fine job of it. And but you're absolutely right. Go to a nursing home. I know the one here, the school comes in and puts on a play, and the choir comes in and sings, and you can go in and out of this nursing home here. The only question they will ask you, is there somebody I can help you find? And they have a big community room where they've always got stuff going on, and these people are up and active, and, you know, and that's the way it should be. That's the way it should be.
Yeah.
They're not drugged and in a stupor and tied into a chair. That is the way it should be. And well taken
uh-huh.
care of. I go up there quite often. And they're very well taken care of and very talkative. Very talkative. You're right. They've got stories to tell. And we could
yeah.
learn a lot. Cos, we're down to the end here. We got just a couple minutes. thanks for the cookies, first and foremost. They're delicious.
Well, thanks for helping me. And I'm so excited we got to get together for Christmas. And this
there
is our last
go.
Show of the year. We
yes,
won't be back on until
is.
Next year.
Right. And everybody out there, and we've got a couple more shows to finish up the year with this next week. And then we'll be down until the first week in January so that we can enjoy our families and our holidays and everybody get stuffed on Christmas Day. Yes. And
yes. And eat lots
so anyway,
of cookies.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm going to have to diet 3 or 4 days behind this just to get off. They are good cause. And
thank
but anyway,
you.
Yeah, you are a good baker, girlfriend. You are a good baker. And everybody,
thank you.
Everybody visit Rosie's Bakery over there. Some good stuff in there. Anyway, we will talk to you, me and Cause, in January. Until then, everybody, enjoy your holiday. Take care of your family. Hang on to each other. You're all you got. And we'll talk to you next year. Thanks, everyone, and good night.
Good night.